is one. The Zionist government, day and night, is proving that it's an occupation government. We have never seen an entity across the globe that celebrates the day it occupied an entire nation. The Zionist government seeks and wants to present itself as an occupation government that has been occupying a whole nation for 74 years. What we saw on May 29 from the intensive presence of occupation forces is simply an assertion that Israel is an occupation and that their ideology is one of occupation against a people that seeks freedom. The Zionist government took a decision to follow the Zionist extremists of its entity. The right-wing extremists obliged Bennett's government to follow through with the March of Flags, which exposed this government as one that is living in fear of its internal political strife. We all know that the governmental coalition and Bennett's government is on the verge of collapse. This urged Bennett to allow this march to take place with a new route it took, just to position himself as more far-right than the far-right extremists themselves. What the globe witnessed on May 29 was shameful and truly unpleasant. But what made our day was the Palestinian flag that remained held high, despite the intense security situation and the random arrests and oppression in occupied Al-Quds. This flag remained held high as a witness for the occupation's oppressive ways, an attempt to silence the Palestinian people. 74 years of occupation, and the Zionist entity was still unable to Judaize Al-Quds, or to influence the academic curriculums, or to steal and change the cultural heritage of Al-Quds. Every day, the Palestinian citizen, and especially the residents of Al-Quds, prove that they are the righteous people of this land, and that they are keen on preserving their Palestinian identity throughout history. We will remain the first line of defense for our Christian and Muslim sanctities in spite of the occupation.
Well, there's no doubt there, but the high-level precautions that were taken by the Zionist occupation, Mr. Samer, and their allies in the region were very precautious about this march of flags to protect this aggressive young group of extremists known as the Hilltop Youth. What is the reason behind these belligerent precautions? What is Israel really afraid of?
Simply because they know that they are not the righteous people. They are not the owners of this land. They are not the people of true cause. If they are truly owners of this land, they wouldn't have gathered all this security personnel and police force to protect a handful of Zionist settlers. If they were righteous people, they would have walked the path of the old city of Al-Quds without the need for protection. As we know, Israel cannot handle more than one military front line. Israel faces security threats on its southern front line and on its northern front line. Also, the situation in the occupied West Bank and internal occupied territories are set on a boiling plate. The Zionist entity perfectly knew that the situation can explode at any time, which means a complete collapse of the security and political system inside the occupation entity's government. This prompted them to increase the presence of their occupation forces on the southern and northern fronts, even in the West Bank and the occupied Al-Quds. Israel did all that to protect a handful of Zionist extremists known as the Hilltop Youth. This reflects that the Zionist government and this occupation is founded on the blood and skulls of the Palestinian people, a regime that has historically been built on an iron security fist. What is more important is that the Palestinian people were still able to preserve their identity, despite the horrific scenes and vast oppression that they experienced during the March of Flags. Palestinians still were able to remain steadfast despite the occupation's iron fist.
And added to that, Mr. Samer, all Palestinian resistance factions raised their alert level inside the Gaza Strip, as you just mentioned now, in anticipation of a possible military confrontation erupting not only then, also probably in the coming days, in parallel with sending messages through a lot of mediators to the Zionist entity. But where is the Arab and Islamic involvement, Mr. Samer, livelihood and their dignity throughout all this oppression and aggression that we saw on Sunday.
Being a nation under occupation for 74 years so far, it's only normal to remain on high alert. As for the Arab regimes, in light of the suffering the citizens live through, we still see that these regimes race and compete to normalize with the Zionist entity. We saw how there are certain Arab nations, well known for their normalizing ties with Israel, who try to mediate with Gaza not to respond for the Zionist provocations in Al-Quds. However, as long as the Palestinian people is under occupation, then they will remain the frontline defenders for their nation and their land. The Palestinian people have been suffering since the Nakba in 1948 and is still suffering from the same disappointing stances of these Arab regimes. All these regimes seek is to achieve regional calm while completely forgetting an entire nation living and suffering under occupation. We only have hope in our Arab brothers and sisters, not in their regimes. The official Arab regimes have their own political priorities that are completely different than that of their citizens. Here lies the tragedy. The Palestinian people does not promise anyone with victories, but rather we promise our brothers that we will remain steadfast. The Palestinian people is ready to absorb all this oppression another 74 years. But until when will the Palestinian people be capable to remain steadfast in light of the waves of normalization hitting the Arab world? I believe that Israel is the biggest winner in all of this. Israel, which claims to be seeking peace, has tricked all these Arab regimes to make sure that it remains the true ruling leader in our region.
As you just said, Mr. Samer Khalil, that our trust is in the nations and not the regimes. I want to thank you very much, Samer Khalil, political commentator, for joining us from occupied Al-Quds Sharif. Thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Iraq's new draft law that criminalizes normalizing with Israel.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In Iraq, the draft law criminalizing normalization with Israel, which was presented by the Sadrist movement's deputies and was approved in the first reading, raised questions about whether it aims in one way or another to circumvent the initiative of the coordinating framework for a political solution, which includes a clause criminalizing normalization. Regardless, Muqtada Sadr knows that it is difficult for him to impose such a law on his two partners in the tripartite alliance, Masoud Barzani, who was engaged in a process of normalization with the enemy dating back to the days of his father, and Mustafa Barzani, and Muhammad Al-Halbousi, who is allied with normalized countries led by the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Iraq criminalizes normalization in this following report.
Iraq's parliament has voted to criminalize any form of normalization with the Zionist entity Israel, threatening the worst offenders with life imprisonment or the death penalty. The law has been condemned by apartheid Israel and the U.S., of course, while most Iraqi politicians in Baghdad have welcomed it. Meanwhile, amid cautious silence so far in Erbil, Iraqi political circles are claiming that passing a bill to criminalize normalization with Israel in the Iraqi parliament is not without internal political calculations. Many Iraqi observers are pointing out that this step is an attempt by the leader of the Sadrist movement, Muqtada Sadr, to achieve self-marketing after he failed to achieve any of the stakes placed on him as the winner in the legislative elections. Whether with regard to resolving the internal crisis that the country has been witnessing for nearly 8 months, or in passing bills that ease the impact of the economic crisis on Iraqi citizens, as in the case with the Emergency Food Security Bill. The Sadrist movement pushed this bill about a month ago, after accusations leveled against it for turning a blind eye towards the suspicious relationship between its allies in the Save a Homeland Coalition, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, and the Sunni Sovereignty Alliance, along with Israel. Iran has repeatedly accused the leaders of the Kurdistan region in northern Iraq of dealing with Israel to harm the Islamic Republic, and this coincided with the hints of some tribal figures who recently returned to the Iraqi scene that the sovereignty coalition, especially its leader Muhammad al-Halbusi, is implementing an Israeli agenda in the heart of Sunni geography in Iraq. Some Iraqi observers believe that the aim of the draft law presented by the Sadr movement in the House of Representatives was not to prevent the enemy's penetration into the Iraqi arena as much as it aimed to facilitate the formation of a majority government with the participation of the sovereignty coalition led by Muhammad al-Halbusi and Masoud Barzani's party. It is more likely, as suggested by the statements of those opposed to al-Sadr, that the draft bill, which needs to be approved in two further readings before it becomes effective, aims to get ahead of the efforts of the Coordinating Framework bloc, whose political initiative included a call for the adoption of a law criminalizing normalization with the enemy. The irony is that after Tehran targeted a Mossad headquarters in Erbil weeks ago with a number of missiles from where attacks against it were launched, Muqtada Sadr sought to deny the relationship of the dominant forces in Iraqi Kurdistan with the enemy and to condemn the Iranian bombing. Therefore, the probabilities today indicate that including this issue in the political bazaar aims to fill a large gap in the tripartite alliance that al-Sadr relies on to monopolize Shia representation within the Iraqi authority and thus rule Iraq as a whole.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Baghdad is Sheikh Dr. Yusuf Al-Nasri, who is the Iraq's general coordinator of the global gathering in support of the choice of resistance. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri, for being with us from Baghdad. Now, last week, the Iraqi parliament voted unanimously on a proposal to criminalize normalization with the Israeli occupation. It is not a law yet, but what does it mean for Iraq?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful, thank you for tackling this important topic for Iraq and the region. This draft bill that the Iraqi parliament voted for to criminalize normalization with Israel is simply a reaction to the so-called deal of the century. We witnessed several Arab states collapsing one after the other, competing to take part in this deal. The fast pace to broker this deal is the increasing strength of the resistance that encircles the Zionist occupation. Add to that our people's awareness alongside the strength of the resistance from Yemen passing through Persian Gulf nations to Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, and Iran, the nurturing and supportive power for the resistance. This huge axis, which is now also growing in North Africa, poses a real and strategic threat to the Zionist entity. Now we all know that Iraq is witnessing an exchange and alteration in politics and power between different blocs. We have a government formation that is being agreed upon in Iraq, and here is where an initiative was born to mend the rupture in Iraqi politics. The draft bill was a first step for the resistance axis in Iraq to criminalize normalization with Israel. Yes, we have several remarks concerning some points in this draft. But the first successful step is to make it illegal to make ties with the Zionist entity. This pushed all the agents of Zionist Israel and the U.S. into a real dilemma. From here, we can say that this draft bill was a bold and successful move.
Everything that you just mentioned, Dr. Nasri, is very important for Iraq, but many Iraqi media reported that the draft law presented by the Sadrist movement in the House of Representatives to criminalize the normalization with Israel was not aimed at preventing the enemy's penetration into the Iraqi arena as much as it aimed at facilitating the formation of a cabinet in a majority government in Iraq with the participation of the so-called sovereignty coalition led by Mohammed al-Halbousi and Masoud Barzani's party. How do you assess such a claim?
I believe that lately, a serious conflict arise between the Sadrist movement, coalition, and Parliament Speaker Halbousi. Add to that in Iraq, there is a powerful axis, carefully observing all the alterations at the political level. And this places the Sadrist movement at an embarrassing spot. This pushed the Sadrist movement, led by Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr, to take this step to prove whether or not his allies, Halbousi and Barzani, can handle huge strategic projects in Iraq. From here, Muqtada al-Sadr tested his allies with this draft bill, especially after the Islamic Republic bombed Mossad positions in Erbil, after they had used Kurdistan to attack Iran. This places Sayyid Sadr in a very embarrassing position, pushing him to in turn embarrass his own allies after it was confirmed that Kurdistan housed Mossad agents. Either they prove they are patriots and choose to stand firm with him or not. This is why this draft bill was at the top list of the Iraqi parliament session under the supervision and support of the Sadrist movement. After this session, we saw that Barzani ditched the Sadrist movement and their coalition now is at the verge of collapse. However, Sayyid Sadr exposed them by pushing this bill forward. With this draft bill, Sayyid Sadr wanted to assure his firm stance against the Zionist entity and expose his allies who were openly accused of normalization. This was an appreciated and successful step for the Sadrist movement, despite the fact that we do have certain remarks concerning some of the bill points. So we hope for the correction of some of the law's details.
But this is an indication that a conflict might arise in Iraq, Dr. Nasiri, because Erbil was the center of normalization conferences with the Zionist entity in which one Sheikh Wissam al-Hardan participated in the last conference by orders of al-Halbousi himself. And even al-Halbousi himself wrote the final statement of the conference that was held in Erbil. This is what al-Hardan stated. So is this that draft law criminalizing normalization only maybe a trick with which it is intended to mislead public opinion?
When this draft bill becomes a law, it will definitely lead to strategic conflicts inside Iraq, simply because it exposed the real intentions of some politicians in Iraq, like the Kurdish Democratic Party, headed by Masoud Barzani. No doubt that Masoud Barzani has close ties with Israel. It's not a secret, because he never hides it, just like his father before him. Kurds even send Peshmerga to get military training inside Israel. This is not hidden, on the contrary, they show these ties off. In proof of that, look at the mobile protests Kurds held in Erbil, where the disgraceful pro-normalization conference took place. The Kurds protested holding Israeli flags in the heart of Erbil, calling for open relations with Israel. However, this clear decision to criminalize normalization with the Zionist entity was a much-needed and bold move. The will and awareness of people, along with patriotic movements and blogs, is to stay away from every project that has to do with the Zionist entity. Sure, Halbousi and Barzani have been influenced by Western powers because they were brought in by the pro-Zionist Americans. However, they were exposed and they are now on the way to be held accountable by law. Our problem in Iraq is the conflict between patriotic movements who both support the resistance. It's about time that these patriotic movements join forces and stand together for the sake of Iraq. Instead of building alliances with weak coalitions, resistance blocs should build alliances amongst themselves, which is why we believe that this law came along to clean Iraq out of any Zionist agents and traitors.
Well, it seems that we will be looking at grave changes in Iraq, hopefully peaceful ones. I want to thank you very much, Sheikh Dr. Yusuf Al-Nasri, the Iraqi General Coordinator of the Global Gathering in support of the choice of resistance, Secretary General of the Shura Ulama in Iraq, and the President of the National Council of Trustees of Religions in Iraq. I want to thank you very much for your contribution from Baghdad, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Brothers and sisters, we're talking about su'udhan. Su'udhan, or thinking badly of others. And we said this is a serious spiritual disease. One of the things that I'd like to talk about is the idea of looking at the root cause for su'udhan and seeing if we can explore this from the root and then fix it at the bottom or at the core. If we look at why it is that we as a believer, sometimes when it comes to the actions of others, somebody does something. They email me. They text me. They call. They don't return my salam. Whatever it is, the interaction that I'm having with a believer, and then a thought creeps into my mind. The problem becomes, as we learned before, when I change my behavior or my words based on what I heard or what I thought. Su'udhan. Now, what we want to do is figure out what's the root of this. Brothers and sisters, one of the important roots of this disease is our imagination is running wild. Let me explain. Our imagination is not acting the way that it should. In Islam, brothers and sisters, how many ayat of the Quran do you hear that emphasize us doing ta'aqqul, thinking? Again, the Islamic way of thinking. Acting on hujjah. How many ayat of the Quran? When I'm acting on su'udhan, my su'udhan allows me to think about my brother or my sister in a different way. It's because not hujjah, but rather my imagination has taken over. In Islam, we're looking for the aql to be guiding us and leading us, not waham, not our imagination. So in Islam, and this is, I'm going to share a hadith that's a principle, brothers and sisters, because what happens is we might think, well, many people think, everybody's got aql. Why is it that they're... The definition of aql for us, brothers and sisters, is the same thing that we have from our Prophet where he says, Al-aqlu maktusiba bihil jannah. For us, the Islamic definition of aql is that by which the jannah is gained and earned. Jannah. We want that kind of an aql that leads to those kind of decisions, as opposed to decisions which are based on waham. So, what happens? Instead of aql being our guide, instead of aql and hujjah being the thing that makes us make correct decisions, what we find is that if we have su'udhan and we act on it, instead of me acting on aql and hujjah, what I'm acting on now is my dhan, is my imagination, what I think. This person, maybe they went this. I'm reading the tea leaves. I'm coming to a conclusion. But is that hujjah? Is that aql? Is that an Islamic way of thinking? No. We learned before that the hadith of the Prophet was this. He says that beware of dhan, of su'udhan. He says that it's the biggest lie What I'm doing, in my mind, I'm coming to a conclusion about my brother or my sister. This sister meant to do this to me. This brother said this and he was trying, right? This person didn't respond to me. They thought this about me. The Prophet in the Hadith says it's the biggest lie. Without hujjah, I'm coming to a conclusion. I'm saying that this is what the person is thinking. Fixing this means to go back to what Islam says. So in our verses of the Quran, one of them is this. It says, وَلَا تَقْفُ مَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٍ. Never follow something where you don't have ilm, you don't have hujjah, you don't have proof. Following it, acting on it is very dangerous. The wrong thing to do. Or another verse where Allah says, إِنَّ الظَّنْ لَا يُغْنِي مِنَ الْحَقِّ شَيْئًا. سُوءُ الظَّنْ, thinking in that way, going based on my imagination, without proof, without Islamic hujjah, coming to conclusions, that doesn't help at all when it comes to the truth. That's not considered haq. It's not considered haq. So I want to give you some examples. Let's see if you can. The thing that happens to some of us is this. Let's say, I'm going to talk about a way that su'udhan becomes rooted in our character. Sometimes for some, have su'udhan about somebody. I think this brother or this sister was trying to do this. Sometimes it turns out to be right. I had su'udhan. I thought badly of this person. And they did have something up their sleeve. This, sometimes when this happens, we get hooked to it. I acted on, let's think about this carefully. I acted on waham. Waham turned out to be right. Now I depend on waham and I believe in it. Instead of using the process and going through it, I'll give you another example. Let's say somebody, instead of doing the thinking process as Islam says, I use istikhara. Islam said, think, don't say that this is God thinking for me. Allah make the decision. No, you think about what weigh the possibilities, go based on what you can see. If you are completely, you don't know what to do, not hadith, not ayah, not Mushawara, nothing is showing you, then now, yes or no, yes, istighara. But not, this is God telling me and thinking for me. But now, think about this. Let's say there's a person, a brother or sister, who turned out to do istighara instead of doing the divine process, and incidentally, I bought this house and it was great. I was thinking to buy this business and it did work out. Sometimes what happens is you'll find the person abandons the path of acting on hujjah, acting on aql, thinking about it, weighing. Now for me, istighara, because it worked. It becomes rooted in. Waswas. I'll give you another example. Waswas. This is again, these are just different examples. What we're trying to do is come to a conclusion. I'm not supposed to act on waham. I'm supposed to act on hujjah. I'm supposed to act on ilm. We read the ayat of the Quran. But sometimes I'll act on waham. I'll read the tea leaves and it turns out right. Let's say somebody is a person who has waswas. I have waswas. So because I have waswas, I always assume everything's najis. Islam told me, assume that it's tahir. God said, assume that it's tahir. But for me, I have waswas. And instead of me listening to Imam Ali, I want to get it right. So then I'll act on my waswas. Imagine if I act on it and then I discover there is something. Now I'm addicted to it. Because I think I got it right. But I made a mistake. God doesn't want me to act on waham. I'm not supposed to do that. So now, what we have to do is practicing to retrain the intellect, to retrain the mind, not to act on my gut feeling. Hujjah. Not to think, well, I got it right, and then if we act on it, it gets worse. I'll give you some of the hadith. It's the same thing with waswas, by the way. If somebody, instead of taking the principle of the Ahlul Bayt, you have waswas, you're not sure, for you is tahir. I'm not sure the number of rakats. God said, consider it. The prayer is correct. I act on it. I'm going to try and figure it out. It gets worse. The imagination, waham, is now out of control. It gets to some strange places. Su'udhan, if we obey it, it can take us some places. The mind is a very powerful tool. We have to learn to retrain it. Think as God said to think. Trust in God. I don't have to be careful of everything. I serve a good God. If I do my takleef, God's going to fix it. I don't have to figure everything out. But acting on it makes it worse. The Imam says this. He says, "Man sa'a su'u dhannihi biman la yakhun." The person who ends up thinking badly about a person who didn't do khiyana. They weren't betraying me. They weren't. But I had su'u dhann. I acted on it. He says, the Imam says, eventually I'll end up hasuna dhannuhu bima la yakhun. I'll start to believe in non-realities. Those will become real for me. But it becomes so serious. Sometimes we have to go for therapy because I wouldn't listen. I wouldn't stop. It's that serious.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. This is Muhammad Javad hosting this program, and my two guest speakers in the studio I've invited are Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, salam alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum as-salam, glad to be here.
Sayyid Abdullah, salam alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum as-salam and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Today, let's start criticizing the movie Hotel Mumbai. This is a 2018 action thriller movie directed by Anthony Maras, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of the pronunciation of its last name. Well, starring Dev Patel, Armie Hammer, and so many actors and actresses. The whole movie is about the hotel staff risking everything to keep its patrons, the hotel patrons, safe during a terror attack, especially a British heiress, her husband, and her infant. Before we talk about this movie and the beginning of our critique of this movie with Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, let's take a short listen to a part of this movie or a trailer of this movie, and then we'll be back criticizing it.
Perfect, thank you.
Dinji, where am I tonight?
Shall we get a rescue?
Remember always, here at the Taj is God.
Let's move!
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program, in which we try to criticize the movies, not necessarily based on the movie artistic features, usually based on their themes, such as this one and the previous movie that we try to give a critique about. Today in this episode, we are trying to criticize the movie Hotel Mumbai, directed by Anthony Maras, produced in 2018. This is the budget that we are talking about. The budget of this movie was $17.3 million. However, the box office was $21.1 million. And Rotten Tomatoes holds the approval rating of 76% with the average of 6.8 out of 10. Whereas Metacritic gives an average score of 62 out of 100. Sayyid Abdullah, how did you like this movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The movie was okay. I mean, it was quite, in terms of the way they tried to draw the events and what took place. It was very direct, very up to the point. There was no time wasted.
Mm-hmm.
So from the beginning of the movie was like, if you take the first 5 minutes and then it's just bang, kind of kill 'em movie.
Yeah.
So they were very direct, very straight to the point. So it was, it kind of kept you watching the whole time without having to lose focus.
I see. How about you, Brother Hussein? How did you like the movie? Did you like it at all? Like the previous movie, Patriot's Day?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It was good. I still liked it. But this movie was intense. I mean, it was very vulgar. It was very controversial, mm-hmm. actually. But overall, it was pretty well made. I liked the flow of it. It was pretty nice, actually.
Mm-hmm. You know that it was based on true event, which happened in 26th of November 2008.
Yeah, actually. I mean, obviously the true event wasn't as good as a movie, but... it's still a big
the
tragedy.
The event is not as good as the movie?
I mean, it wasn't good at all.
Okay, so you want more real
action.
No,
but the movie itself, it was not bad. It was like Brother Abdullah said, it was pretty straight to the point.
Yes, I see. Okay, before we again criticize this part of the movie, let's take a listen to that part, and then we'll be back talking about that part and criticizing the movie Hotel Mumbai, produced in 2018, directed by Anthony Maras. Stay with us.
Tusi taakatwar mehsoos kar rahe ho. ਤੁਸੀਂ ਸਕੂਨ ਮਹਿਸੂਸ ਕਰ ਰਹੇ ਹੋ ਤੁਹਾਡੇ ਦਿਲਾਂ ਦਿਮਾਗ ਵਿੱਚ ਕੋਈ ਡਰ ਨਹੀਂ ਤੁਹਾਡੇ ਭਾਈਆਂ ਦੀ ਅੱਖਾਂ ਵਿੱਚ ਤੁਹਾਨੂੰ ਮੈਂ ਨਜ਼ਰ ਆਵਾਂਗਾ ਤੁਹਾਡੇ ਚੋਂ ਹਰ ਕੋਈ ਮੈਨੂੰ अपने पुत्र दी तरह अजीज है। मैं तोड़े नाल हाँ, अल्लाह तोड़े नाल है, जन्नत तोड़ा इंतजार कर रही है। अल्लाह अकबर।
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We are trying to criticize the movie Hotel Mumbai, a 2018 action thriller movie, which was based on true events, which happened, in fact, on 26th of November 2008. Of course, the movie was produced in 2018, 10 years after the bombing and the terrorist act on, in fact, the Hotel Mumbai. Well, you know, there is this pep talk, Sayyid Abdullah, by, of course, the mastermind on the other end of the line on the phone.
Yeah.
You know, they're shouting, or the mastermind on the phone talking to some of these, or group of terrorists in Urdu, suggesting that no fear, you're going to go straight to paradise or heaven. And it ends with God is great. Yes. Allahu Akbar.
Always.
Right? Always. Yeah. Why is it always like this? Isn't the goal of the media of the sort to, like, destroy the image of Islam one way or another?
Well, with all these terrorist actions, and, like, whether it's in real life, the thing that I hate about movies is that they never try to portray the actual reasons to why people commit what they commit. For example, in Mumbai, Mumbai itself, if you look at the history of it, for years, like since the 90s, it's been subject to terrorist attacks by the Pakistanis. And if you read the history correct, you will see that Pakistanis and Indians, before Pakistan even became a country, it was part of India. So they always had this feud between them. And even to recent years, it almost turned into a nuclear war. So they kind of have this feud.
There are a couple of these regions, if I'm not mistaken, like Kashmir, for example, which is like subject to lots of controversies and
disputes. So Kashmir itself was under
between
siege.
India and Pakistan.
Yeah, Kashmir itself was under siege like a couple of years ago by the Indian police and stuff like that, and a lot of people got killed.
And also Bangladesh, which got separated.
Exactly.
By the way.
So the Muslims back then in these regions, they were prosecuted by the Indians, or by the Indian government itself. So these people were retaliating for what they think is an abuse of India and its government. So it's
but
not
under the flag of religion.
Exactly.
Or something like
so
that.
It's not. The motive is not Islamic motive as much as it's trying to take revenge on what's happening to you and to your land.
Yes.
But when it comes to the movie, though, it becomes an Islamic terrorist. Because now we have the perfect cake to present to the world to dig in. Islam, let's dig. Right? So, and then again, like you said, you began with Allahu Akbar. Why do terrorists say Allahu Akbar? Well, I mean, if I want to go fight, I've been to battle myself many times. I've never said Allahu Akbar when I had to fire my weapon. Why? I might say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, but Allahu Akbar. So that's the thing, because, you know, when you try to put a word, and like any Christian now, or any person in the West, when you say to them Islam, they know, everyone knows Allahu Akbar. Yeah. Everyone says Allahu Akbar.
They
so
do.
When if they hear it in the Adhan, when the Adhan goes and say, the first thing we say in Adhan is what?
Yeah,
Allahu Akbar, right? Four times in Adhan. It's like, oh, here we go again, right? So they're trying to associate
but we
anything
also
bad
hear,
with Allah.
Sayyid Abdullah, but we also hear this terminology or expression, whatsoever it is that you want to call, in lots of like video clips that come out on like virtual world or cyberspace, like suggesting that a group of Muslims shouting Allahu Akbar when anything goes wrong, like a bomb explosion, a mortar explosion, whatever.
somewhere. No, I mean, if you're talking about normal civilians,
yes.
Okay, now me as a person, when something happens, and something, especially if it's out of the ordinary,
as a Muslim, what do you say?
Yeah, I would bring Allah's name.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I mean, I hardly seen people. I mean, I've seen people in bombings. I don't see them saying Allahu Akbar.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, people will be running for their lives here alone, saying Allahu Akbar. So even the movies that you're talking about, or the clips that comes out,
mm-hmm.
I don't think people. I mean. I've seen a lot of explosion clips.
Yes.
I've never seen people say Allahu Akbar.
If I can interrupt you.
Maybe
very quickly,
a bit.
I think it's more of like a go-to word. Like, you know, when you say, oh my God, right? Like when you say something, you say, oh my God.
Yes. Oh my
or say
God.
Allah.
Jesus, for example. Yeah. Like Christians
I think
say.
The people who reported the situation were not Muslims. So, you know, right away their minds went to, you know, there's something, they're saying something in a foreign language and it has Allah in it or something like that. Maybe they were saying mashallah or inshallah or whatever. And they took that as, you know what, it's probably Allahu Akbar. So just write Allahu Akbar.
No, but I mean, I doubt, I mean, the terrorists, they might be saying Allahu Akbar, you never know. But I mean, the media, why do they concentrate so much on the word Allahu
exactly.
Akbar? I mean, even
that's
when they
the
were
point.
Doing their thing, like even when they're not shooting people, they were saying Allahu Akbar. Like saying, okay, you go
yeah,
here,
that,
go
that comes
Allahu
back
Akbar.
To
I'm like,
the,
it's not a, like a goodbye thing.
To the
thing.
Survivors yeah. who heard them and reported back to the thing, right? That's how we know the
no,
story.
No, but there are scenes where these guys by themselves, they're not with people.
Yeah.
And they still, like, when they say
exactly.
to each other,
so
bye, they
maybe
say,
they
Allahu
didn't
Akbar.
Know. They're like, you know what? Let's just put Allahu Akbar. It sounds right.
Well, there you go. Why Allahu Akbar?
Terrorists, Allahu Akbar?
Is it, yeah. Exactly. Right me, so they're right? trying to associate anything bad
exactly.
with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Simple as that.
Yes, exactly. And they yeah. did it so much, and they emphasized it or highlighted it so much that everybody, even non-Muslim, knows it, yeah. all right? When someone just shouts in the bus or
if you say
on
Allah,
the plane.
If you just say Allah, now people like get scared
yeah,
because
exactly.
that word's in their mind.
They get shocked or something.
I tell you a funny story that happened. So my sister once she was on the plane and when the plane took off, she got scared. She said, Ya Allah. And everyone around her, they ducked in. Right? Because she kind of shouted. She was
young.
What
is ducking going to do?
Yeah.
Right? So everyone ducked in. They thought, like, all right, here we go. She was dressed in black.
Yeah.
Can't see nothing from her face. She's going to blow herself up. So that's what exactly what's happening, that people drone anything terrorism with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah. And you, Brother Hussein, for your nice contribution, for being with us in the studio, criticizing the movie Hotel Mumbai, produced in 2018. Directed by Anthony Maras. This is Muhammad Jawad hosting this program. The program was Viewpoint, the movie critique program. We try to criticize Hotel Mumbai. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
There's been a big shooting at the CST station.
Not bad. You're very safe here.
Security, can we get security now?
Let them in!
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
It was in 1979 that Iran's semi-modern monarchy was upheaved by a full-scale Islamic revolution, with the clerical school taking the reins of rule. 43 years later, the father of the revolution is being commemorated, 33 years on from his demise. Imam Khomeini passed away at almost 90 on June the 3rd or Khordad the 14th in 1989. The anniversary falls to June the 4th in 2022. The ceremony has traditionally been held in his mausoleum between Tehran and Qom since it was completed in 1992. It's not the mausoleum I've brought you to, however, but the Imam's living residence. That's at the other end of Tehran in leafy old Jamaran, north of the capital. What thoughts might the Imam have planned to put into practice from these very premises? For some answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. His thoughts he voiced years before the revolution, since 1962 and 3, which is what sent him into exile. But he returned from Paris with a religious doctrine 1st of February to seal the revolution on the 11th of February or 22nd of Bahman, 1979. The latter is marked as Revolution Day. Rather, Islam was to be the supporting ideology behind the government. Reasoning for this claim is based on the fact that the Imam put the matter to the people's vote, a referendum, so to speak, asking if they wanted an Islamic Republic, yes or no. Our guest, Mr. Fawzi, however, disagrees about the Imam's intentions altogether.
The late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, maintained that an Islamic government must be established. He also held that Islam has provided not only the general outlines in the area of politics, but also the details. The question is, given that any system of governance requires a set of laws and a ruler, are there any teachings in Islam about the structure of government, that is, legislation? Imam Khomeini's answer to this question is yes, as religion dictates that the Islamic rules and laws must be enforced in the society. Therefore, the process of legislation in a Muslim government must be based on the Islamic rules.
The Imam's vision of what his religious rule would look like if it materialized can be deduced from his address to the youth of France. It was France that he returned to Iran from, riding on revolutionary calls rising over Iran's horizon. Here's how the Imam put it. We want to implement Islam, at least Islamic rule, in such a way that you understand democracy as it should be. Be it that all learn that democracy exists in Islam in a form very different from what is claimed to be democracy by presidents and monarchs. It is noteworthy the Imam's religious doctrine was not anti-Western per se. He believed in adopting Western technology and teachings to adapt to Islamic Iran's needs and beliefs. This is similar to his belief that politics must pass through a spiritual sieve, that is, religion, Islam to be specific. The revolution's achievement went beyond, however. The state is an Islamic republic, and all three powers are today principalist, although the president and MPs are elected by popular vote. This is the most recent development, however. Otherwise, over the past 2-3 decades, the country has been somewhat alternating between principalists and reformists for presidents. And finally, it elected a moderate Rouhani, the president, just before Raisi. Mr. Abu Talebi is of the clerical rank Hujjat al-Islam. As an authority on the matter, he noted relevant flexibilities and red lines.
Within this religious framework, we seek to use human wisdom and experience. Nothing goes wrong if you use, for instance, foreign electronics engineers, economists, artists, or sports coaches. We have so far used foreign experts in domestic sectors. For instance, we have used the French in the domestic automotive industry or experts from other nationalities in dam building and oil industries. However, it's not acceptable for us that a party believing in the separation of politics from religion come and conduct political activities such as entering the country's presidency or holding a seat in the parliament. Is not possible as it's in contradiction to the principles of Iran's constitution.
It is true that soon after getting a foothold in Iran, revolutionaries received blows from east and west, as they recall it. Blows to all sectors, economic, political, military and security. After all, a fundamental motto of the revolution was neither east nor west, Islamic Republic, with chance against outside influence from either end of the globe. Mr. Taraqi was an MP who's seen the inside of a jail cell pre-revolution.
Imam Khomeini maintained that among the most important reasons for the slow progress of Muslim nations across the world and bids aimed at preventing developing countries, particularly the oppressed nations in West Asia, from becoming stronger were the global hegemony, the world order created by major arrogant powers and the monopoly of power retained at that time by communism under the Soviet Union and the capitalism under the United States.
The Imam's anti-imperialist, anti-colonial approach changed Iran's political status in the region. Anti-oppression freedom movements anywhere were inspired by his ideas, such as the Islamic resistance movement.
The Americans say that after the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, we were worried that Iran could be more dangerous to the Persian Gulf littoral states than the Soviet Union. Prior to the Islamic Revolution, they added, we were constantly concerned about the possibility that the Soviet Union would orchestrate coups in the Persian Gulf littoral states and help governments come to power with approaches close to those of Moscow. But after the Islamic Revolution, we were afraid that governments such as the one in Iran would be formed in these countries.
After what Imam Khomeini did, new thoughts have been formed and promoted across the world and in the region, as a result of which practicing religion has gained greater popularity. The Islamic Awakening movement was formed, Islamic groups have become more active in Muslim countries, and Shias have managed to end their isolation, as you can see in the case of Houthis in Yemen.
As for national achievements since the revolution, they are a sign of how national self-confidence was given a boost or played on. Iran's revolution moved the country out of the West camp, so to speak, putting an end to the amicable, although not terribly balanced, trade balance between Iran and the US. This, in turn, was cause for greater caution on the part of the Islamic Republic, as well as its effort to progress.
The Iranian nation's success in foiling the plot hatched by the enemy to occupy Iran within 1 week and continuing the war for 8 years were proofs that Imam Khomeini had managed to, by creating self-confidence in people and increasing their spiritual power, strengthen the Iranians' will to an extent enabling them to stand up to and resist all these problems, pressures and difficulties.
Islamic rule with democratic-style elections was a threat to capitalist and socialist ruling formulas. A country run as such with scientific potential could be a role model to other states. And scientific independence for any third-world country of the time would threaten global markets and big bucks of the powers. America was one of Iran's two great trade partners at the time of the revolution. The other partner was West Germany. Already extensive bilateral trade relations between Iran and America peaked in 1978 when imports from the U.S. were over $3.5 billion and Iranian exports to the U.S. were just under $3 billion. The imbalance was mostly in the nature of the exchange. But powers politics didn't leave it at that. With about 50,000 Americans living in Iran, the U.S. exported technology, industrial equipment, and agricultural and consumer products to Iran. There was a period when Iran, a sufficiently fertile land, notably imported 50 to 75% of its rice, wheat, and cereals from the U.S. This is while a year before the revolution, as much as 98% of Iran's exports to the U.S. were oil exports, with non-oil products making up just 2% of the total. Iran's was a single-product economy dependent on oil resources, after all.
Imam Khomeini also maintained that basically within the international system, countries have been placed next to each other in an unequal and unbalanced manner. There are states with great power and countries that are subordinate and inferior to them. In addition, the relationship among these countries has a hegemonic nature, an instance of which is the United Nations Security Council, where a number of powerful member states have veto rights. Thus, Imam Khomeini was a critic of the existing international system. At the same time, he would say that Iran has to have a smart interaction with other countries based on its national interests. It means that we need to retain our relations with those countries that have equal and just relations with us and stand up to those states that seek to dominate us.